Hello and welcome to today's episode of The Growth System, the podcast that looks at the world of B2B growth through a systems thinking lens. I'm Colin Shakespeare.
And I'm Chris Bayliss.
And today we're tackling a challenge that we see in B2B companies more than most, although to be fair, there's no shortage of famous examples from the B2C world. And that is, how do you deal with shiny things? Now, you know what I'm talking about. There's those new trends or technologies or ideas that suddenly seem to be everywhere. And sure, they're way outside your organization's core competencies, but the leadership don't want to miss out on the gold rush. And before you know it, your industry-leading service management platform is being marketed as the AI platform for business transformation. I'm looking at you, ServiceNow.
Yeah, I was going to say, mentioning no names.
I'm going to name ServiceNow on that one. To be fair, Chris, maybe hyped up buzzwords are just sort of superficial marketing trends. But I think it's fair to say we've seen shiny object syndrome play out time and again in much more serious and risky ways, and sometimes kind of funny ways to look back on, like remember Snapchat spectacles or Google Plus, or does anyone have a Microsoft Zune at the back of a drawer somewhere ever since they replaced it with an iPod and then ultimately an iPhone? Or how about a BlackBerry Storm?
I liked a BlackBerry Storm.
did you have a BlackBerry Storm? Well,
I did have a BlackBerry Storm, yeah.
Wow. It got me thinking during the research, you know, is the metaverse shiny stuff? We thought a lot about purpose-driven strategy in this episode, as I'm sure we'll come back to. And looking at Meta's vision statement, it's to give people the power to build community and bring the world closer together. And I think, to be fair, you could probably argue about whether or not the reality of Facebook itself really it sort of ladders up to that vision, but it's at least easier to see how that core social media business ladders up to that vision statement. And I think by contrast, after all the initial enthusiasm and the billions in funding, the metaverse isn't actually bringing us closer together or helping us to build communities, or certainly not any community I've been asked to be a part
not
of.
Not what I want to be a part more of. About me.
But I guess as a serious question, what was the opportunity cost of focusing on this sort of shiny new virtual world? Pursuing shiny things on a serious point without careful consideration can lead to strategic failures, wasted investments, missed opportunities, and ultimately a damage to brand reputation. Not all new trends or technologies are beneficial for every business, contrary to what you might believe if you just sort of lived life through your LinkedIn feed and followed the latest trend every year. I think without a framework to evaluate whether shiny objects align with your long-term strategy, companies are vulnerable to being seduced by these shiny things, as we're calling them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we were planning this episode, we came across so many examples of big companies full of smart, presumably very logical people making decisions that in hindsight seemed totally illogical. Colin, why don't you get us started with one of these examples, and then we can maybe have a go at unpacking it?
Yeah. No, that. Oh, okay, great. So let's start with one that... It's 15 years ago this story started now, and it seems not so long ago, although hard to imagine we were in this world just 15 years ago. Do you remember Cisco and their ill-fated venture into consumer electronics, and they bought the flip video camera? Which to my mind now, when I look at it, just looks like a phone.
Yeah, I didn't remember this one. I don't know how this one passed me by at the time, but yeah, it's definitely qualifies. I see why you've picked this one as the first one.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure the audience all knows Cisco, probably the behemoth, the giant in networking and enterprise telecoms. And they acquired Pure Digital Technologies for, I think, close to $600 million. That's the maker of this flip video camera. Just a simple pocket-sized device, literally about, kind of looks like a phone pretty much now, or what phones look like now anyway.
Yeah, it looks like that Motorola flip phone, doesn't it? Do you remember the sort of little silver one? It's kind of that, isn't it, for people who haven't seen it?
Sort of, yeah. Worth looking up, actually. I think it was actually really popular at the time, to be fair, and appealed to sort of casual users who wanted an easy way to record and share videos, which I think people forget that 15 years ago, that was, smartphones hadn't really nailed video recording. And so this was a thing, that a capability that people were looking for. And I think there was a really growing trend at the time of user-generated content, and Flip was this gateway into the consumer electronics market. Why they would want to do that, I don't know. But it seemed like a promising move for Cisco to diversify. And actually, the timing couldn't have been worse. As history shows, basically, smartphones like the iPhone rapidly evolved. And pretty soon afterwards, high-quality video recording was a standard feature on smartphones, and you didn't need a separate device, just like you no longer needed an iPod, for example, because your phones can do it all. I think Cisco really lacked experience in consumer electronics, and they just couldn't keep up with the speed of innovation. So the Flip camera just didn't really align with their core strengths in networking and telecoms, the thing that they're known for. And they faced strategic drift and couldn't really reconcile their identity, who they are really, and what their purpose is, with this new adventure into consumer products. And ultimately, the Flip division diverted resources away from their core business and weakened their focus. And 2 years later, after the acquisition, Cisco just shut down Flip. Over 500 people lost their jobs, completely wrote off the investment. I think it became just a classic example of a strategic failure caused by just overreaching into unfamiliar territory. So I think the decision to refocus on their core competencies and get the hell out of consumer electronics really underscores the, and so soon as well, underscores the risks of chasing these short-term trends without fully considering the strategic alignment and the big picture. So, Chris, what's your thoughts on all this? Like, well, how does a company as successful as Cisco make a $590 million mistake? And I guess what's the systems view on this?
I think this is such an incredible example, like literally incredible, because I just don't know how a business as smart as Cisco, with such a defined kind of niche in the market, actually greenlight something like that. But you know, I've done a little bit of research. I've definitely got a point of view. But you know, before we kind of dive into the specifics, let me lay out my thoughts at a fairly high level. I think what you have to ask yourself here first is this a decision-making failure, i.e., it's a rubbish idea in the first place, or was it an execution failure, i.e., it's probably a good idea, they just ballsed up the implementation of. And yeah, in this case, hindsight tells us that it was categorically the former. I mean, it's got to be. Cisco, the world's most successful, as you said, networking and enterprise telecoms business, making a consumer electronics product with an unproven market demand, you know, simply is not a good strategic decision for that business. And that's the key thing. It's not saying Flip was a rubbish idea, certainly not when it was conceived. If it had stayed independent, arguably it would have become a phone company, perhaps, and it would have done the feature convergence the other way around.
That would have seemed like the logical direction to take it.
Yeah. Absolutely. You can see how that would have worked. What you can't see, and what I can't believe they did see at the time, was how Cisco had a meaningful role to play in that. So I guess the question that we need to answer then, or at least try to answer, was how did this decision and its accompanying $500 million expenditure actually get approved? I think it's probably also worth noting at this point that we've got no insider knowledge of these scenarios. We're just using them as a mechanism to illustrate how, you know, to avoid the allure of shiny things, to kind of stay away from the shiny strategic object until you've really given it a really good look. So if you're listening to this podcast and you were there, then please do feel free to mark our homework in the comment section. We'd love to hear what actually went on and maybe how close some of our hypotheses get. So perhaps a bit of historical context to start off here, because I had a really good look at this. As I say, it wasn't an example actually I had kind of front of mind. So the acquisition of Flip happened in 2009. And I think what's interesting here is this is 8 years after the dot-com bubble burst. It's right in the midst of what I think we now refer to as the first financial crisis of many that have seemingly become rather too much a feature in the world since then. This was the subprime mortgages in the US. It was also a little more than halfway through the tenure of Cisco's longest standing CEO, a guy called John T. Chambers. He joined the company in 1995. In the year 2000, Cisco stock was trading at $77 a share. I mean, it's never got back to that level 25 years later. In 2009, when they acquired Flip, it was down to $10 a share. And I think the whole market then, arguably as now, was kind of shaped by this notion of the quick win, like the next big thing, the sort of Bay Area, Silicon Valley dream of, you know, scaling the unicorn. And I think this kind of market context combined with what must have been insane shareholder pressure to get the company back to the valuation it had enjoyed and probably where a lot of these guys had invested, must have been absolutely massive. You know, the B2B world then, I think particularly then, was still fairly cautious. And portable consumer electronics were exploding as a market category. You know, I think we've got to remember that, you know, whilst you kind of mentioned there was still quite a lot of evolution in the phone market, the iPhone had been in the market for 18 months by the time they did this acquisition. So the writing was on the wall. I mean, this was not a small event. You know, I don't remember Flip. I definitely remember the launch of the iPhone. You know, I had one right out the box. It was a game changer at the time. People knew it was a game changer. And they still piled in, you know, 18 months, 2 years after the fact. So, you know, you think that an acquisition that size, it would have been talked about for quite a while, to be fair. So maybe the talks were ongoing as kind of iPhone launched. Maybe. Now, I don't know this, but I would be shocked if Cisco weren't armed to the teeth with analysts' reports, you know, telling them that entering this market was a great idea. And clearly everybody from the board to the shareholders to the whoever lent them the $590 million, because I imagine they probably didn't have that in free floating capital. Typically speaking, not that many businesses do everything straight out the balance sheet when it comes to M&A activity. You know, the accountants must have signed it off. Everyone thought this was a good idea, and it so obviously wasn't. So why was this, I guess? For me, there are two interrelated things going on here. The first is something that we actually discussed briefly in the last episode. That's this concept of sort of bounded rationality. You know, the idea that a decision can make perfect sense in one part of a system, but actually makes no sense whatsoever when looked at either from a different part of the system or within a broader context. And I think that sort of bounded rationality has to have been at play here. They were looking at what they wanted to look at, or they were only looking at a specific set of things. You know, it's another way of saying, I think, a really common phrase, which I think is so descriptive, probably far better than bounded rationality, and that's blinkered decision-making. You know, like those little things they put on horses. You know, I think it's a brilliantly descriptive phrase, as I think in business, generally in business, not just Cisco, we have a bit of a tendency towards narrow, you know, taking narrow views of problems. I think there's a bit of a there's sort of a solid human reason for doing this, right? You know, the brain can only deal with so many variables. And that leads to this sort of reductionism that we've talked about before as well. You know, what John Chambers and the rest of the board must have been focused on was all the smart people telling them that the numbers made sense. You know, what they must have been motivated by was the shareholders breathing down their necks to turn to turn things around, to kind of get that share price back up. Yeah, you just know that way before the acquisition was even serious, they'd probably made the decision to take a risk, you know, to try to get rich quick, to change the fortunes quickly. And undoubtedly, you know, their decision was blinkered from the wider market context. It just has to have been. So, you know, you sort of asked for the systems view. Well, I think the systems view is that they'd probably drawn a system boundary around the problem. And, you know, within the context of that boundary, it probably seemed like a great idea. You know, it clearly must have done. They spent nigh on 600 million on it. I mean, what's the value of 600 million now, you know, 15 years later? It's like a $1 billion investment, probably. You know, I think that in many ways, this is the business case for systems thinking as an essential business skill. I think we said maybe in the teaser, this great phrase that I listened to one of the, I don't know, the leading lights in systems thinking say to me recently was that systems thinking is the cognitive skill of the 21st century. And I think this is because it's a tool for managing complexity. It's a tool for understanding complexity. And I think that they probably could have done with a few more systems thinkers on the board back in 2009. So I guess this leads to another question, which is, what weren't they looking at? You know, what was outside the boundary? The bounded rationality they used that made them think $500 million investment in Flip was a great idea. Well, probably there was quite a lot in terms of market and consumer insight. You know, I already mentioned that the iPhone had been out for a couple of years before it started to go wrong. In fact, actually, I think having done a little bit of Googling, which may not be entirely accurate, but I think like iPhone 3, which was the first 3G product that actually enabled video, was already out during the ownership. So, the writing, if it wasn't on the wall at the start, must have been clear pretty quickly. I think that's evidenced by the fact they only gave this thing a go for 24 months before they shut up shop. And from a systems perspective, I think the big thing that was clearly missing was a strong enough sense of purpose. You know, you alluded to it in the intro, the sort of purpose-driven strategy. It's pretty clear, I think, that they were missing a strong purpose in Cisco at that time, or certainly a clear purpose of where they were trying to take the business to. You know, purpose should create guardrails in which decisions get made for lots of reasons, some of which we'll try and cover. Companies with strong purpose make better decisions, they make more money, and they do it because they move forward with greater clarity. You know, they make less strategic missteps because they know where they're trying to get to. And I think the trap that Cisco fell into back then was to confuse share price as being a legitimate purpose. And ultimately, I think if you'll take one outtake on purpose-driven strategy from this episode, it's that financial reward, whether that's share price, whether that's market valuation, whether that's revenue, profit, whatever, is never a purpose that is legitimate. All you're doing is to try and make money, you might as well not be doing it because it will be self-defeating. Share price, going back to the systems view, is an emergent property of a successful system. You know, it is a byproduct of what you do well strategically. It's not why you do it. And I think that is something that if Cisco had really known at a deep level, you know, what it was for and what it was trying to achieve, it would never have sanctioned, you know, a diversification of this kind. Because there's just no way that Flip would have passed the purpose test. You know, we are the best known name in enterprise networking. What role does a consumer electronics product play within that? Zero. You know, it wouldn't have passed the first board meeting or, you know, slightly boozy lunch or wherever that idea came from. It just wouldn't have got out the traps. And because that's so obvious, it's so obvious, I think, that purpose wasn't clear in Cisco at the time. Yeah, these kind of strategic guardrails are essential tools in keeping systems on course because they help manage the decision-making rationale of the human beings in the system who are notionally at least in control of it. This is not strictly a systems book, despite the fact it's got some system word in it, but a book that I love and I would really recommend you read, it's a bit heavy going, but is called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. I think he actually won a Nobel Prize for it, if memory serves me correctly. And he talks, this isn't really what the book is about per se, but he definitely talks about purpose-driven decision-making being a tool to manage human thought processes. So the book really is about what he calls system one and system two thought, intuitive thought versus analytical thoughts. In essence, he argues that too much of one or the other leads to bad outcomes, leads to bad decisions. You need to have a balance of analytical and intuitive thought, and that purpose can create a kind of good guard against cognitive biases. You know, what he describes, the sort of human condition is that we can be blind to our blindnesses. I think this is what a political commentator's name, I can't actually remember off the top of my head, called unknown knowns. You know, it's that is that it's pretty clear what those biases are. We're just not looking at them. And they allow us to have that bias towards one system of thought or another. And I think that if Cisco had had that purpose, the cognitive biases of the management team, the, you know, intuitive, instinctive gut reflex to get away from the shareholders and get towards the place that they wanted to be, and actually potentially the other side of that, you know, you think maybe that's the reason. It could actually be that they were too biased towards the system two analytical view. All the analyst reports said it was a great idea, so it must be a good idea. They hadn't tuned into the intuition of, wait a minute, we're an enterprise networking business. Does this make sense?
Good point, yeah.
Yeah, it could be one or the other, but I think fundamentally that bounded rationality, that bias towards one of those systems of thought that wasn't propped up by the sort of purpose as the strategic guardrails, was what happened there. I think actually this was interesting to me, but to put this systems failure, and it's a monumental systems failure, it's quite a famous systems failure. Interestingly, Flip doesn't actually make it into the top 20 of Cisco acquisitions by value. So they've clearly, you know, done a bit of other M&A activity that worked a bit better than Flip over time, and I think this is probably evidenced by the fact that, you know, John, that CEO, stayed as chairman until 2015. I believe he's still chairman emeritus, so he clearly didn't lose too much trust within the board at that time. So clearly, it wasn't the end of the world. But I think we can all agree it's not a mistake you'd want to make twice.
Yeah, indeed. I think when you put it into context like that, you start to get a sense of sort of how large it loomed in the consciousness of the big decision makers at Cisco. But still, a monumental failure, and one that would have been avoided just by a sort of purpose-driven approach to strategy. And I think you could draw kind of close parallels between that and things like the Microsoft Zune, where these things like the iPod and the iPhone perfectly align with sort of Apple's, both their place in the market and their purpose and their purpose-driven strategy. And really, it seems like in these cases, Microsoft and Cisco, that it would be very hard to make a case how these things fit with their purpose or strategy or core competency. Or, I mean, Cisco's a B2B company, for goodness sake. But yeah, a monumental failure to look back on. But as you say, in the context of the wider picture at Cisco, perhaps, you know, not even in the top 20 acquisitions by value. Going back to a sort of purely B2B case, and one on a order of magnitude a greater scale, I thought I was going to say fun, but I don't think it is a fun story. An interesting one to talk about.
None of these are fun if you were there at the time.
one to look at might be GE's attempt to break into Predix, that attempt to break into the Internet of Things market. Very ambitious, a little bit later than the Cisco story, still over a decade ago. 2013, I think, was the launch. They trying to transform themselves from, I mean, to say their hardware focus is probably an understatement, but this industrial sort of hardware giant into a digital leader. I think the idea behind it is really to create a software platform that could connect industrial machines and gather huge amounts of data and analyze it in real time to be able to predict failures and optimize performance and ultimately boost industrial productivity. Like what could possibly be bad about that idea on the surface? I think GE had a really bold vision with it, So they didn't just want to build better machines. They want to make those machines smarter and more efficient using data. And they weren't shy about investing in it. And I think estimates that I've read, pretty much every source seems to agree, $7 billion they poured into Predix. As I said, on an order of magnitude greater than the Cisco Flip investment.
Absolutely. I mean, that was probably their expenses budget, wasn't it, what they poured into Flip?
That was the boozy lunch where they decided to do this. That was the bill. I think it's supposed to be this crown jewel of GE's digital transformation. That's the platform that's going to propel them into the future. And of course, no one's talking about Predix now because it didn't go according to plan. It struggled to gain traction. Customers found it too complex. It didn't really scale as easily as GE had hoped. There was lots of issues around the usability and a sort of lack of a really clear fit with the various sort of diverse needs of the industrial sectors it was targeting. So GE, known for its manufacturing heavy equipment, really found themselves in uncharted territory, like competing in the software industry. Yeah. They just didn't really have the same level of expertise or, to be frank, experience. I think by about 6 years ago, 2018, they started to pull back and scale down their ambitions and eventually folded in kind of what they had into their other digital offerings rather than trying to continue to push this as a standalone platform. And I think for all the time and effort and the billions they invested, it didn't really deliver the revolution that GE had hoped for. A bit like the metaverse in the B2C world, frankly. It just didn't deliver what they set out to get from it. And I think it became one of the big contributors to GE's kind of much publicized financial struggles during that period, almost kind of, again, on a greater scale than what was affecting Cisco at the time. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, how does a company with such a strong industrial background stumble and venture into digital to such a, I guess, a big failure? Like, what's your take on what went wrong here? Is this even a case of shiny object syndrome, as we called it at the start?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, actually. I mean, when I knew that Predix was on the list, I, again, you know, did a little bit of background reading. That $7 billion investment, for what I can see, is turned into one flat white page on their website with more or less no links on it. I mean, crazy, crazy amounts of investment coming more or less to nothing. But, you know, I perhaps would take a slightly different view on this. I certainly don't think it's the same situation as Cisco found themselves in with Flip. You know, I sort of remind the listeners, we're very much armchair experts here. I don't exactly have a perfect view of the industrial IoT market. It's not a, you know, not a core competence of mine. But, you know, I suspect what we might have here is a different kind of systems failure. You know, I'm not suggesting that Predix isn't a case of shiny stuff, but I don't think it's quite such an open and shut case as Flip was for Cisco. When we talk about shiny stuff, I guess probably, and I'd never really considered this before, but I think we can probably put it into two categories at least. You know, Cisco was chasing fool's gold. Predix might have been trying to extract a particularly tricky diamond, if that's not too much of a, you know, forced analogy. Both types of shiny make you re-divert resources, you know, away from business as usual. But I would argue that Predix was at least much more closely aligned with purpose. So I don't think this is a failure of purpose here. In fact, actually, I looked up GE's vision. I couldn't find specifically what GE's vision statement was in 2013. It might have changed. But reading it, I suspect not. And their vision statement is, I've got it written down here, to become the world's premier digital industrial company, transforming industry with software-defined machines and solutions that are connected, responsive, and predictive. Which basically sounds like IoT, right? I you know, it certainly doesn't seem like that is divergent from their purpose. It maybe suggests they're not done with it yet, although I have, again, absolutely no information on that.
It's a hard sell to the board, that one, now after $7 billion.
I think it could be. I mean, sunk cost fallacy, it's a thing. You know, they who knows? But I think what we probably can say is that Predix would have passed the purpose test. you know, it definitely aligned to the vision, certainly the one that they have on their website now. So, you know, as a decision-making process, I think the criticism you could probably leverage at GE was one of cognitive bias, you know, a little bit like what we were talking about before. They place too much emphasis, I suspect, on their experience in the industrial sector in the sort of decision to progress with the project. I think they probably forgot that they are not, and still are not, a software company. You know, they're a hardware company. You know, they make jet engines and, you know, huge industrial pieces of machinery. You know, that they are very much a product business in the sort of, you know, hardware sense. And they decided to make a $7 billion investment on being a software company. Yeah, that's a big punt. That's a big punt. And when you have $7 billion to play with, you quite conceivably could become a software company with that. You know, with $7 billion, I think you could do pretty much anything. Certainly when it comes to being a business that starts up, certainly plenty of software companies start up on a hell of a lot less than $7 billion. So I don't think that was necessarily the problem in itself. You know, if you get the implementation right, and I think the true systems failure here actually was implementation. It was probably the, you know, what I might term the strategy to execution gap. I think that this played out probably in a couple of different areas. You know, they failed to understand the complexity, the sort of fragmented nature of the market they were entering into. I think they probably also failed to realize that Predix wasn't another GE product. You know, in many ways, it was an internal startup. You know, they were starting a software company. I get the sense from what I have read that that isn't how it was viewed internally at the time. It was viewed as a product line. It was a new jet engine. And I suspect that's probably where it started to unravel right at the start, that the sort of paradigm they were viewing the investment through was wrong. So ultimately, what they most likely tried to do was fit Predix into their existing system rather than recognize that to succeed, it probably needed to operate in a more agile way that wasn't constrained by the standard sort of mechanisms and processes of the wider GE business.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't quite thought about it from that angle yet. I think an interesting place to dive in here would be talking about that strategy to execution gap that you mentioned. So how can systems theory help us bridge that gap?
Okay. I mean, I believe that it probably does come back to purpose in many ways. You know, as we've discussed before, companies are goal-seeking systems. So the primary variables that you're going to play with in a goal-seeking system are the goals, right? So, you know, how you set goals, and I think particularly how you create the governance structures around the attainment of those goals is a really important lever that we can use in closing that kind of strategy to performance gap. In the last episode, we talked about alignment between sales and marketing, and in the case of Predix, you know, the scope of that alignment is way, way wider than sales and marketing. You know, I'm sort of imagining a system dynamics diagram here, and it would be colossal. But the principles are the same. You know, it's about vertical and horizontal alignment of goals to strategy. It's about clarity of purpose. It's about interfaces between the different kind of entities within the system. And okay, so let's talk about entities. So, you know, a system is comprised of lots and lots of different entities. They can be physical, they can be informational, even organizational. So like human structures within organizations, org charts, you know, that's a sort of entity relationship. And I think in essence, strategy is structure. And what I mean by that is a strategy tells you how you're going to achieve an objective by harnessing the resources you have in the organization, right? So whether they're human resources, financial resources, IP, processes, whatever, you know, they're all entities in a system. And strategy is how you drive the entities towards the goal. So, you know, strategy is structure. Strategy is kind of the formation and function of entity. Last week, we talked about some of the levers that we can use to influence system performance. You know, you might recall I said these were pretty consistent across problems. And when we think about how GE might have closed the strategy to performance gap, I think we come back to some of these same levers again. So one of the most effective levers we discussed is goal setting. You know, we mentioned that sort of goal-seeking system piece a second ago. You know, this is how we guide the purpose of the super system, not a phrase I'm not sure we've used before, but fundamentally we think about the top system, maybe in this case, in our boundary we're going to draw around it as being GE, the big business. And GE is full of subsystems, and getting the right goals within a goal-seeking system is essential. Otherwise, we're going to fall into the clutches of that wrong goal trap we've talked about before. And I think it's reasonable to assume that GE didn't do a great job of aligning all the subsystems that make up a monster project, like launching and selling and marketing something like Predix. Sort of a coherent set of goals laddering up to their ultimate goals was what was required here. Now, I can't comment on how well they did this, but quite clearly, strategic drift happened quite early in this project, and that says to me that that wasn't right. Another lever that I really strongly suspect was not pulled in the right direction was the way that they sort of managed and enabled the sort of self-organizing principle of teams, of systems. From what I've read, GE has very strict rules around organizational governance, compliance, you know, decision-making processes. And when you've just launched an ambitious internal startup, what's required is agility. I mean, probably what's required before agility is recognizing that you've launched an internal startup, which I'm not sure necessarily was the case. You know, you need that agility, you need the ability to pivot quickly, you need the ability to adapt to market feedback, all those things that we characterize startups as having and being good at. And I don't think they were present. So I think it's reasonable to assume that the constraints GE placed on the way its teams made decisions hampered their ability to self-organize, by which I mean to change or evolve the structure of their teams, of their processes, you know, of the way that they kind of went about achieving their goals in their subsystem components. So I think ultimately GE tried to be something it wasn't. And whilst it was, you know, what it was doing wasn't actually, as we were kind of saying, necessarily out of line with its organizational purpose. It didn't adapt its system structure to enable the resources it deployed, considerable resources it deployed into the project, to actually succeed.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting take on it as well. I think we probably better start wrapping up before we end up out of time. To close out, why don't we, kind of following the format of the season so far, why don't we share a few personal outtakes that the listeners can use to make sure that they don't end up in the same situation as GE or Cisco?
Why don't you take us away, Colin, if you've got a couple?
Well, I guess something that became really clear to me, I mean, as I kicked off the research for this and I was thinking about sort of shiny object syndrome and what fun it would be to look at some of these systems failures and about big respected businesses sort of diving in and making mistakes and weren't they so silly. But I came to realize that this is ultimately a sort of endemic systems issue, and it's perhaps the message about purpose driven strategy needs to be, I guess that's part of what we're doing here, right, is disseminating that message that purpose comes before strategy and should define what the strategy is. It's not a component of strategy that you use in your marketing copy and your corporate social responsibility statement. It should actually provide these sort of guardrails that guide your decision making. And I'd like to kind of go deeper into purpose-driven strategy, maybe not in this series, but as the show continues. And it was really interesting what you had to say once again about sort of bounded rationality and I guess setting these kind of limitations on the boundaries on the system. and not really thinking about, you know, perhaps anticipating the complexity of new technologies or a new strategic direction, like a big manufacturer like General Electric starting an enormous software startup, really underestimating the sort of complexity of going into that market and what that would involve as well. Or indeed, and just thinking of it in a sort of bounded way about the Cisco case was a classic one of just thinking about the short term, thinking about your sort of quarterly goal and thinking about the share price essentially and what can we do about that. And actually, a sort of purpose-driven strategy there would have steered them away from making the mistake that they made. And I guess there's another point just to kind of round off. You touched right at the end there from the GE Predix case, where they kind of failed to imagine what it would take to make a business like that successful. What I mean by that is, they just appear to have attempted to kind of plug in this completely different type of business into the processes and the way they do things at GE, rather than actually reimagining what it would take and kind of reimagine. It's almost like the creation of the sort of organizational design of GE was seen, it was obviously very successful, and it was seen as being sort of set and forget. And of course, we're going to go into that as we go into the series, a bit more into that set and forget mentality. And actually, when it comes to something like this massively different type of business venture that they went into, it was quite clear that they needed to think outside of the GE-shaped box there.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that sort of reductionist tendency was probably present in both of these cases. And, you know, I think that is, I guess, the antithesis of taking a systems view. You know, where let's try and boil the problem down to the smallest possible set of parts in which we're going to make decisions with. And you know, that's ultimately how they missed what the benefit of hindsight showed us was probably quite obvious. For me, two things maybe stand out, maybe things actually that I probably wished I'd maybe talked a lot more about. I think the first outtake for me in terms of like how we avoid these things happening is respecting the value of information. You know, I touched briefly on interfaces, and we talked about like measuring goals that tell you something meaningful about system health. And even if you get your goals right, which I'm not sure they did, you need to be sharing and distributing the information about attainment of goals with the greatest frequency possible, enabling those teams to course correct and kind of stay on track towards achievement, or at least knowing when like bigger pivots need to take place. So I think that having a clear view of goals and then measuring your attainment of those goals properly and having that information clearly and obviously available to everyone that needs it with a strong, you know, focus on the frequency of information is a good way to understand whether you're on track towards your plans. Obviously, better is making sure that your goals were right in the first place, whether you're tracking them, but let's maybe take that as read. I think the second, and this is maybe more of a philosophical point than a systems point, but it's to pay attention to what's important, not just what's kind of quantifiable. You know, all the analyst data in the world cannot replace intuition and personal understanding of the world around you. I guess this is partially about system boundaries and your kind of scope of discovery, you know, making sure you're taking into account the broadest possible view of the information, make sure you're taking into account your own cognitive biases, making sure that you're kind of feeling and sensing the environment in which you're operating in. So I think that, you know, this is about maybe to some degree having those, backing yourself when you know something's not right, but also maybe the opposite, being prepared to take risks, but doing so with as broad a view of the system and the context in which it sits as you possibly can get. And I think that is probably the broader kind of rallying cry for systems thinking in these kind of scenarios, as if ever there was one.
I feel like this has been a really rich topic, and actually it's sort of brought more questions in my mind and areas that I'd like to explore, I think, on future episodes. Been actually quite fascinating. It's been really nice to kind of zoom out. Maybe we were a little bit in the weeds with MQLs, and I think that's a place that does deserve some attention, but it was great to kind of zoom out to the strategic level and think about purpose.
Yeah, nice to see systems in action, you know, when systems go bad.
When systems go bad. We should call the special that if we're still going to do that. Well, look, I think we've overrun less than normal, let's say. I'm gonna call time on it there and say that that's all we've got time for this week. The Growth System, as always, is brought to you by RevSpace, an applied growth consultancy that connects B2B organizations with the future of growth. Of consultancy, education, and applied delivery services. Don't forget to follow and rate the podcast. It really helps us to bring the content to a wider audience, and we'd really appreciate a moment of your time to tell us what you think. That's all we've got time for this week. Thanks very much, and hopefully you'll tune in again next week.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.